You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. A major renovation is underway at the historic Warrior Hotel in Sioux City. Closed for more than 40 years, the real estate company Restoration St. Louis is giving the old building near 6th and Nebraska new life. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer toured the Warrior Building yesterday with the owners of Restoration St. Louis and talked with them about the transformation of the Sioux City landmark. Here's her conversation with Amrit and Amy Gill.
The building does need a lot of work, but it has fantastic bones. She's an elegant lady, and when she's done, she'll be the most elegant lady in the entire region. This is one beautiful building. Yes, we have only remnants of the plaster left. We have only remnants of beautiful columns. I almost want to say Corinthian columns, but all this will be replicated and brought back, and you'll have a beautiful bar right there with a restaurant, a ballroom. This will be the lobby with the front desk, and very Art Deco.
And we're actually standing on top of a big staircase that's in the middle of the facility because this at one time was one of the grandest hotels in the region.
Oh yes, definitely. I think everything that happened of significance up until the time it closed, if you read the news articles, it's like this president was at the Warrior, this announcement was made at the Warrior, this wedding was at the Warrior. So I think that's the beauty of this, is we'll be able to bring this back and bring back that kind of elegance and grandeur that Sioux City had lost.
What kind of things will we find here once it's completed?
Well, a bowling alley, a spa, two-story spa with massage rooms, manicure, pedicure stations, a swimming pool, sauna, restaurants, some kind of a rooftop, hasn't been totally finished being designed yet, and of course a beautiful restaurant and bar, which all those things combined will make this the focal point of the community again, just the way it has been for generations prior to shutting down.
Yeah, and there's a ballroom and conference facilities. But the ballroom, I just think of all those people whose grandmothers got married here, who could get married here and have the pictures side by side. You know, I just think it would be so awesome to do that and have those kind of memories go down through a family. So I think that's really exciting.
You were talking about rooftop. I think we're open all the way up to the ceiling, right? We had things kind of falling on us. Is it a little bit of snow?
Just a little bit of snow.
A little bit
that's
of snow.
All.
That's
it's
all.
It's not going to hurt us.
You two have been working on rehabilitating buildings and actually rehabilitating neighborhoods and cities over the years.
Yes. So our mission is to strengthen and enhance the communities we operate in by redeveloping neglected neighborhoods. And so we're not the typical one building and done kind of developer. We do entire neighborhoods, and we bring entire neighborhoods back to life.
And you've been doing this, what, since
29 years.
29 years.
Yes.
30 years married,
yeah.
29 years in business together. So four kids later and 400 and some odd historic buildings. So it all works, you know. It's funny, when we talk about it now, we started in a three-family apartment building that we lived in, you know, and ended up owning it through a foreclosure sale, and now here we are, you know, in Sioux City, Iowa, so it's awesome.
Why did you pick Sioux City? Why did you pick the Warrior? I know you talked about how this building has great bones and it has a great vision for the future, but why did you choose Sioux City?
So Lou Weinberg, who's owned this building for a while, and the Davidson, came to St. Louis and recruited us, and we came here and fell in love with the community.
Very cool. And as you said, the Davidson building is also part of the plan.
Yes. Yes, it is. The Davidson will have hotel rooms from 2 through 5 or 4, and then the top two floors will be luxury apartments. Beautiful luxury apartments like Sioux City doesn't have today.
Do you think this is something the Sioux City economy can afford? I know that we talk about a workforce. It's hard to find skilled workforce. Do you think this is a facility that might be something that Sioux City couldn't sustain?
Oh, I don't know how it couldn't. In fact, it's a facility that Sioux City can ill afford not to have in operation, because it'll be a net gain for the local economy. There's going to be over 200 people working in these two buildings when they're completed, between the hotel and the leased restaurants that we're going to have on the first floor of the Davidson. 200 jobs in the center of downtown Sioux City. It all starts with jobs. People have to have jobs in order to live and thrive, and we're going to help with that situation as well.
And meaningful work. I think that's a big thing. You know, we are now in the age of the service economy, and I feel like people who work in hotels have a different attitude. You know, they're helpful and friendly and they're excited to be here.
For example, our senior vice president of sales is carrying tables up the staircase. And he's a senior VP.
You can hear the crews working on the building. Do you have a timeline on when it will be finished?
Oh, yes. Summer of 20. It'll definitely be finished, all of it. With Warrior, it may go a little faster, but for sure by the summer of 20, we'll be completely finished with both buildings. So, because Warrior is mostly cleaned out now, so we're starting actual construction inside, putting up, well, you can hear they're drilling the holes for the plumbing and all of that, so that's already going on. Versus Davidson still is in demolition because there's stuff inside, old offices and things like that have to be taken out. We're so happy to be here, and we're so lucky that the city council and the mayor and everybody embraced this project. And, you know, I think the thing I would like to say is just thank you. Like, thank you for welcoming us to your community. Thank you for welcoming us into your city. And, you know, we're so excited to be here and working on this project. It's taken 38 years for the city to get it off the ground, but you know, it'll be here shortly.
The cost of the restoration project that includes the nearby Davidson building is $73 million. The Gills were credited with revitalizing another river town in Iowa, Davenport. They opened the Black Hawk Hotel there in 2010. It's a Marriott Autograph Collection hotel. Once finished, the Warrior will have the same designation given to luxury hotels by Marriott. The Gills first got involved in the Warrior Hotel project after Sioux City developer Lou Weinberg, who owned the Warrior and nearby Davidson building, reached out to them a couple of years ago. For a look inside of the Warrior Hotel, you can go to Siouxland Public Media's Facebook page. Crews started working on the building January 7th. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Last week, a proposal resurfaced in the Iowa Senate that calls for eliminating tenure at state universities. The measure cleared one legislative hurdle after a Senate Education Subcommittee approved it January 30th. Several lawmakers have expressed concerns about the effects of the measure, as has the Iowa Board of Regents. The regents have issued a statement opposed to the measure. Josh Lehman is a spokesman for the board, and he explains some of its reasons.
The board opposes the bill. Tenure allows our institutions to recruit and retain the best faculty to teach, do research, and provide service to advance the institutional missions of our public universities.
We talk about the mission of the public universities. Some who are defending tenure say, you know, without tenure, it's hard to attract the best teachers and the best researchers.
Well, and that's right. Our universities are competing nationally for the best and brightest faculty in their fields, and eliminating tenure would severely impact their ability to bring in those best faculty and to retain them.
Over the last few years, the number of tenured professors at all three schools has dropped. Is that something that the regents are concerned about as well?
Well, we want the best faculty. Approximately around 60% of our faculty are either tenure or in the tenure track. So we want to have the best, and tenure can be a part of that. If we eliminated tenure, it would inhibit the regents' universities' abilities to recruit those faculty. Iowa would be the only state that would prohibit tenure. So when you're competing nationally, that's going to be a challenge in recruiting.
It seems to be an issue for a lot of folks about funding to the universities, and the thought is that having tenured professors, they'll stay there longer. There'll be a longer, you know, term investment than hiring faculty, you know, for maybe 3-year terms, 2-year terms. It's less expensive.
Well, just like in any business, when you get to a higher level position, there is less turnover than earlier or entry level positions in a business. So yes, tenured faculty do have less turnover, as in any business, upper level management positions in a business. Those typically are going to have less turnover than entry level position. For longer faculty, particularly tenured faculty, there is less turnover than more recent hires. There's a long process. Tenure isn't granted immediately. When faculty go through the process to receive tenure, and it's very, very rigorous.
That was Josh Lehman, a spokesman for the Iowa Board of Regents, explaining the board's reasons for opposing a measure being considered by the state Senate that would end tenure at the state's universities. Higher education researchers and critics also say tenure is important to the health of colleges and universities. Richard Vetter is a distinguished professor of economics at Ohio University. Vetter says tenure plays two important roles.
First of all, the traditional argument for tenure is that it provides them some security against being arbitrarily dismissed or punished for their viewpoints, that it's a way that faculty can express themselves without a fear that their bosses will come along and say, we don't agree with you, we want you out of here. The idea is universities are places for academic freedom, for free inquiry, where even unpopular viewpoints should be have a chance to be expressed. That's the traditional argument for tenure. There's a second argument for tenure that faculty would use, is that it is, in a sense, it's a fringe benefit for our faculty. It provides them with some job security. It gives them protection that you don't get in most other jobs. And so some faculty, I think there are many faculty members who are working for maybe a little bit less money than they otherwise would require in order to take their job, because they know that they have a protection from being dismissed. It takes an awful lot to fire a tenured professor. So those are some of the arguments that are used in favor of tenure.
So what are some of the downsides of tenure?
It is an expensive institution, because when you give a professor tenure, you're really making a commitment of literally millions of dollars. Because if you give a professor at the age of, say, 32 or 33 tenure, who's in, say, an engineer or an economist or someone making a pretty good income, say, close to $100,000 a year, $80,000, $90,000, maybe $100,000 a year, you're saying, we'll pay you $100,000 a year for the next 30 years till you retire, or 35 years. That is literally a multimillion-dollar commitment that universities make. So it's expensive. It's costly. And sometimes enrollment patterns change, or in some cases professors become senile and unable to teach very well, or they get lazy and they barely come to work at all. And so tenure provides a protection against someone who is becoming incompetent or is teaching irrelevant subjects that we no longer need or whatever. So tenure imposes some costs on society as well. And it's in recognition of those costs that states are saying, hey, do we really need tenure? And so that's, I think, is what you're seeing in many states in the United States. One thing that I would point out is that tenure has been losing a lot of its importance anyway, independent of legal actions, because the costs are high for tenure-track faculty, tenured faculty, and universities facing financial pinches have been cutting their expenses, and administrators want to reduce expenses. So they're increasingly hiring faculty who are on what we call a non-tenure track, or for positions for which tenure is not an option. Then they are sometimes they're adjunct faculty, or in some cases graduate students teaching courses, or retired faculty who come back and do some teaching for relatively modest amounts. So we have a lot of that going on too. So the percentage of classes actually taught by tenured professors has gone down quite a bit in the last generation. And I think roughly half the classes now are taught by non-tenured faculty in the United States. I can't speak to say what it might be in say the state of Iowa or Missouri or whatever, the Dakotas or places like that. But nationally, that's the trend.
You've written about the story of a professor out in Fresno who got a lot of flack because of comments she made about the now late Barbara Bush. And a lot of people wanted her to lose her job, but tenure protected her.
Yeah, and I can speak personally to this. I happen to be a professor in a subject, economics, which there's a lot of public policy implications of what I teach. And so I'm often saying things that will get people excited either in a positive way or in a negative way. And at one time, there was a move to on the part of very important politicians in my state, including the governor, to fire me because they didn't like what I was saying. I was opposing policies that they were endorsing, and I was saying things that they didn't want said, and they didn't want encouraged. So the president of my university was received a call from the governor saying, fire this guy. And yet the president was able to respond, I can't fire him. He has tenure, and we're going to, honor our commitments that we've made to our faculty, that they will have these lifetime appointments. So in my own personal case, I received an element of protection, and that element of protection, I think, probably emboldened me to be a little more aggressive in expressing my viewpoints than I would have been otherwise, and I think promoted freer speech and expression and greater a dialogue on the issues of the day, and in my case, this happened to involve a tax matter. Taxes in the state of Ohio, but it could have been any of a number of other issues. So tenure does have its benefits, and it does have its costs, and it's for each state to make its determination what to do. My own feeling would be generally that universities that state governments should generally not impose dictates on their universities, because what goes on in, say, Des Moines may not, the atmosphere in Des Moines or what the community of politicians in Des Moines might say may differ from what the real life conditions in, say, Iowa City, or Ames, or wherever we're talking would be. And I'm sort of skeptical to state laws that would prohibit tenure. because tenure is a fringe benefit that schools sometimes need to have. After all, these schools compete in national marketplaces, and in some disciplines, like most of the humanities, it's pretty easy to get professors. You can English professors, if not quite a dime a dozen, they're pretty cheap. They're pretty easy to find. But in other fields, engineering areas, my field of economics, many business areas, you want to go hire a professor of accounting or a professor of finance, you're going to have to pay top dollar to get them. And if the professor is told, well, you can't have tenure, tenure is not an option, it's going to be hard to get that professor. So by some politician imposing a rule that prohibits tenure, you might actually be preventing the state and the local universities from gaining top-flight faculty who have a national reputation, sometimes even a good reputation for teaching. So there are costs associated with that.
A lot of schools argue there's a real financial benefit in having researchers come to their universities and attracting money to their schools. But isn't there also a benefit to attracting these very gifted people to a school and adding them to the research and teaching staff in general?
Oh, I think so. There's no question that there are positive effects of research. Either looked at very narrowly from the institution's point of view, say the University of Iowa's reputation. The University of Iowa's reputation and Iowa State's reputation have been enhanced because they've had scholars of, in some cases, even world renown on their faculty that have brought honor to the university, have brought also money to the university. Many of these people bring in research grants of large sums, which include an overhead provision that provides some sort of discretionary money to the universities to use. And the reputation of the universities are enhanced by these grants. And from the broader society point of view, some of these grants, you know, lead to real important things happening. Drugs being discovered, for example. At my university here in Ohio, where I am, there is a growth hormone drug that is being marketed by a major drug manufacturer, Pfizer, that has helped millions of people or large numbers of people. It was invented at my university. My university has received $100 million in revenue as a byproduct of this, as part of patent royalties. So there are sometimes some real payoffs. I'm sure that at some level that's happened at Iowa State and at Iowa and even in other schools in your region and across the country, of course.
Richard Vedder is a distinguished professor of economics at Ohio University who writes about issues like tenure and retention in higher education. The bill to end tenure has yet to come before the full Senate Education Committee. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Women Lead Change will hold its Siouxland Conference at the Sioux City Convention Center next Wednesday. The group used to be called Iowa Women Lead Change. Tiffany O'Donnell is CEO of the group. O'Donnell says the organization changed its name because it's no longer about just Iowa.
So we came to Siouxland, for example, and we went to Dubuque. Which had us operating geographically beyond Iowa's borders. You know, in Dubuque, we were in Wisconsin, and of course, here we were South Dakota and Nebraska, as well as Iowa. Add to that, last year, we opened up the Quad Cities. We started doing work there. We even have an office there now. So we were in Illinois. So this organization, while it started in Iowa, became very regional 5 years ago. As part of this organic change, we found that it was time to signal to anyone who wanted great leadership programming for their female talent that were available. Good leadership development, no matter where it initiates. Add to that, we have some partners. This state has some pretty incredible headquarters of some global organizations, and many of them have been with our organization since the beginning. They've gotten to the point where they've been bringing teams into our regional conferences, but they've gotten to where they're using some of our programming, our 12-month Ascent Leadership Program, for example, that's virtual. They're really leveraging that relationship to support their teams wherever they may be. Our Ascent Leadership Program, for example, has an attendee in the UK from our Collins Aerospace partner. So really removing the Iowa from the Women Lead Change makes a lot of sense for us at this point in time.
For this year's conference, you have some great speakers, and one of them is Jenna Bush Hager, right?
Arguably some of the most influential women in our, you know, recent history, growing up in that incredible family. She's going to be sharing some of those lessons that she and her sister have compiled in a book. In addition, though, one of the pieces of this year's conference, I think, that's different than it's been in the past, is that we actually have a two-hour workshop. That whole morning is going to be spent with Lori Frecking, who many of you remember here from television years ago. She is now, she's part of an incredible communications firm that really, she's an expert in negotiation, in communication, and she's going to be doing a two-hour workshop on navigating difficult conversations in the workplace, which is something that we hear from a lot of our constituents. Women tend to not like conflict. We tend to shy away from it if we look at the data. But we also look at the data, and it knows that that holds us back at times in terms of ascending higher levels of leadership. So for 2 hours that morning, we're going to kick it off with Lori Frecking sharing strategic tips and strategies on how to navigate difficult conversations. Then we have a networking lunch, which we've learned in the past that becomes really valuable for teams to not only some choose to stay together, but we encourage everyone to kind of mix and mingle, and you meet all kinds of different professionals from different organizations and industries. And following lunch is the Siouxland Power Panel, I'm calling it, and it's a panel of local Siouxland women leaders, and you'll recognize all their names. It's Mary Stirk, Charisse Yanni, Beth Trejo, and Annette Hamilton. So these are women who are leaders in this community right now, have had an interesting journey on their way to leadership, and are going to be sharing a very personal letter to their younger selves that they've already written, and we'll share those letters, and then we will ask them questions. They're willing to have a moderated conversation, as well as take questions from the audience, which I find is always so valuable when it's somebody you know, somebody who's your neighbor, who's living in your environment, navigating your same culture. It's pretty interesting. So they are the presentation. The power panel goes right before Jenna Bush Hager. So it's a full day of real leadership development for our female Siouxland leaders.
And I think your conference is also helpful for students who want to be involved and really not just sit on the sidelines and watch.
And Siouxland is our standard at Women Lead Change, because Siouxland tends to bring out the most undergraduate women to the program here, which makes me so proud. This is a program that includes an orientation before the event begins. And it provides an outline and some expectations on what our undergrads need to be doing as far as networking, what types of information they should be looking for. I think they provide some challenges for the students to accomplish throughout the day. And then they come together again at the end of the day and share some of their experiences and their networks. What we find too is, especially in the opportunities for question and answers with our speakers, when the students ask the questions, it brings such a different perspective. And they're not afraid to ask questions. You know, sometimes we as adults get a little timid. The students aren't. I mean, certainly the students who come to our programs are not timid, and they bring such valuable perspective. I feel so fortunate. I think we have 60 students signed up so far, and we'll get over 100 in Siouxland, I have no doubt.
That was Tiffany O'Donnell, the CEO of the group Women Lead Change, which holds its Siouxland Conference next Wednesday, February 13th at the Sioux City Convention Center. For information, you can go to wlcglobal.org. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Next week, Tony-nominated lyricist and playwright Bill Russell returns to Morningside College to perform and speak to students. Russell attended Morningside years ago. He'll be speaking informally about his career and sharing excerpts from his most recent musical, Unexpected Joy, which was performed in New York and London last year. I spoke with Russell about his life growing up in Western South Dakota and how it really did shape his future career.
Yeah, well, it's not exactly a hotbed of theatrical activity, but for some reason, I was bitten by a theater bug at a very young age. And oddly enough, Spearfish for decades was the home of the Black Hills Passion Play, which was based on the Oberammergau Passion Play that's done every 10 years in Germany. But this was in a 5,000-seat amphitheater, outside amphitheater. The stage was 3.5 blocks long, including a hill where Jesus was crucified. It had a cast of 20 professional actors for the speaking roles, and then 200 extras who were townspeople, and all these animals, and it was a big, big thing. And it's not that far from Mount Rushmore. So when I was growing up, it was just a huge tourist attraction. It was three nights a week in the summer. And I was in it from the time I was 5 years old. So there was this backstage life with professional actors, and it was just heaven to me.
And you went to Morningside College?
I did, for 2 years, yes. And had a really seminal experience there.
So you say it was a seminal experience. What exactly made it so special for you?
Well, luckily my time there coincided with a wonderful professor named Bill Beckvar, who really inspired me. He opened my eyes to what a director could bring to a production. And he became a mentor and a friend. And he directed my very first musical. So that made it really very special. But also while I was there, my first play, it was a one act, was produced at Clinton Neal. So that was a real milestone. And also when I was there my freshman year, I saw an item in the college newspaper saying there was a manual of summer employment opportunities had arrived in the library. And I thought, well, I'm going to check this out. And I did. And I wrote to all these theater related jobs on the East Coast. And I actually got hired at a resort in New Jersey, about 60 miles from New York City. And I had a really great experience there. That was between my freshman and sophomore year at Morningside. And then I went back a second year. And that's when I met Janet Hood, who I'm still writing musicals with to this day.
You and your creative partner, you've been together for quite some time.
Well, she's not the only composer I work with, yes. But, right, we've written 5 musicals together. Our first musical that either of us had written, we had never written a song, let alone a musical. But I had this idea when we were working at this resort in New Jersey. Hair was, the original production of Hair was on Broadway, and I was obsessed with it. And every day off, I would go into the city and see Hair. And I saw it 7 times, the original production. And I had an idea for a rock musical. I told Bill Beckford this idea, and he said, well, you know, he was going to graduate school at the University of Kansas. And he said, I have a directing slot coming up next year, and I'd love to do an original, so I'll do your show. And this is before, so we had dates scheduled before we had written a note or a word. I mean, and that was crazy. But it happened, and it was quite successful, and it won a national award, and that sort of started us down the path.
You also were involved in popular music and comedy, and you had an album with this really great name, Jade and Sarsaparilla, is that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's a great name.
Yeah. I'm so glad you liked it.
I do.
And we did that album. Janet and I wrote most of the songs on the album, and I wrote a couple with other composers, but that was, we did that for 5 years. They were on national television. They toured all over New England. Had summer-long gigs on Cape Cod. It was really a wonderful experience.
Possibly the piece you're best known for is this Elegies for Angels, Punks, and Raging Queens.
Right. Well, I'm best known for that in Europe, actually. I think in this country I'm better known for Sideshow. But Elegies is such a meaningful piece to me, and I'm just amazed. First production was 30 years ago this year, and we just got back from Germany last month, seeing a production there that was in German that was just incredible, and had a cast of 77, and it's astonishing to me because it's now kind of a history piece, even though AIDS is not over, that it's not only, it's people keep discovering it, like, these German actors, most of them had not heard of it, and they were really excited about it. And so I think it's going to have more of a life in Germany because of that.
Do people ever see this? Younger people see this and say, or you hear that they say that they really didn't understand how terrible that period in time was for a lot of people.
Really shocking how little they know about it at all. I've directed that show a couple of times in colleges, and unfortunately, not only do they not know the history of it and the whole story that the show sort of encompasses, but they don't even know the basics of like how you get it, which I think is really shocking.
You've had such a successful career and a long career, and you're still going. And when you talk to students, say you come to Morningside and talk to students, I bet they ask you, you know, how have you been so successful, and what, you know, looking at their own lives, what do you think it is that makes this happen? What do you tell them?
I tell them to just be open, you know, be open to opportunities, and we all create our own lives. So be careful how you do that, and go after what's important to you. I'm asked a lot by young people who want to be actors, especially, you know, well, should I try this? And I go, yes, if you really want to do it, you should definitely try it, because it's better to try it and not have it succeed than to spend the rest of your life wondering if you really should have and could you have done it, you know. Also, you come to a city like New York, and there are just endless possibilities, and you never know where things are going to lead you. You may not end up being a star. I mean, God knows a lot of people would like to be, but they can't, you know. But you can be involved in different ways and have different success. I just think you have to constantly assess what skills you have that you can market, because part of it is just staying alive. I talk a lot to young prospective actors about having survival gigs and what can you do to make money because you aren't going to in the theater, you know, might as well take vows of poverty.
That was Bill Russell, a Tony Award-nominated singer and playwright, who will be visiting his alma mater, Morningside College, next Tuesday to perform and speak with students. Here's a song from his latest production, Unexpected Joy. And that was the song, When Will I Have My Own, from the musical Unexpected Joy by Bill Russell. This past weekend marked the 60th anniversary of the day the music died. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer has a special report on the tragedy, leaving a long-lasting legacy in one Iowa community.
The crash of a plane in a cold cornfield in northern Iowa remains frozen in time. The day, February 3rd, 1959. Forever remembered through the song American Pie.
The music died.
And descendants of those who witnessed the aftermath.
But my grandfather would tell stories where it was probably, I don't know, maybe 500 yards from their farm and just about 7 miles north of Clear Lake. And he wondered what all the commotion was, so he just walked over there.
The whole country mourned the lives of three talented performers, Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper.
Hello, baby!
All gone as their careers started to soar.
And then when I got into the news business, then I ended up covering it. I remember covering, I think it was the 35th anniversary in 94, where we would go to the winter dance party and do live coverage, and it was always a million below zero, kind of like it is right now. Now you know why planes don't fly well in that kind of weather.
Journalist Brian Mastry started his television career nearby Mason City. Mastry, who now works in Omaha,
Brian Mastry reporting from Chicago, Illinois,
lived in the shadow of history.
I was growing up not far from the crash site when La Bamba came out, and I remember the family of Richie Valens coming out in the cold northern Iowa winter and going out to the scene. At that time, there wasn't much there.
The community of Clear Lake remembers the talented trio with a celebration of sound and solidarity.
It is such a large part of our history, and fortunately or unfortunately, what we're known for. And it's our mission to keep the ballroom open and alive, but it's also our mission to keep the legacies of Buddy, Richie, and the Bopper alive, too. Their music changed music forever.
Lori Leitz is the executive director of the Surf Ballroom and Museum, the last place where the fallen stars shined, where every year for the past three decades, fans converge to remember a pivotal point in history.
This was 60 years ago that we lost these three guys, these musical legends. Why do you think people still remember them?
Music changed. It was at that time, it had gone from country to rockabilly, and rockabilly kind of opened the door to rock and roll. And a lot of the people that were here celebrating this music were teenagers, and this was kind of the first rock and roll or music tragedy, and they could all tell you exactly where they were standing when they heard this. They were just shaken, because this was something these pioneers were giving them, this music that they loved and enjoyed so much.
The music during this year's sold-out event attracted people from 37 states and four countries all together
for one common bond.
A lot of them are dressed in the period clothing with the poodle skirts and the saddle shoes and the white t-shirts and the, you know, the cat eye glasses and you name it, just a lot of fun. So they call themselves the February family. So they come from all over the world, and some of them say they wouldn't care, you know, who's on stage. They just come to see their friends, to enjoy the music, to relive a simpler time, I guess you could say.
One winter dance party seasons ago even brought out a living legend at the
They're
time.
They're one of the first people to interview Waylon Jennings when he finally decided to come back to the Surf Ballroom.
A long time forgotten, our dreams just fell by the way.
He was the bass player for Buddy Holly. He had stayed away from him for so many years. I don't know if you guys remember the story, but it was, you know, he gave up his seat for the Big Bopper. And that just, he just told me that just weighed on him, you know, because he felt like it should have been him. It was a big moment for him, and he wasn't sure how he was going to handle it. And my recollection is that they had tried for years to get him to go, and he always said, not interested. And for whatever reason, time probably, he finally came back.
February 3rd, 60 years ago, people say it's the day that music died.
Yeah, that was the term that they've coined. We know ourselves as where music lives, because we have so much energy and so many people celebrating the legacy, and the event sustains itself because of the interest and the importance of the music. And so I guess in the words of one of the crickets, you know, every time you play Buddy Holly, rock and roll lives.
Love will not fade away.
Living history with sounds of a time gone by, playing out on the stage of one Iowa town.
It's tragic what happened in these young lives that were taken from the music scene. Their music still lives on, and I think it's remarkable, and I think it's a testament to Clear Lake that they kept this going still.
For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Sheila Brummer.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie. Cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, you give me all your loving and your dirty loving, all your hugs and kisses and your money too. Well, you know you love me, baby. Tell me maybe that someday will I'll be through. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie, cause.
And that was Buddy Holly singing That'll Be the Day. Well, that's it for this edition of The Exchange. Thanks to Sheila Brummer. I'm Mary Hartnett, and we'll see you next week.